Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com.
From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point, a monumental week in the news. The United Kingdom decides to break from the European Union.
The total number of votes cast in favor of leave was 17,410,742. This means that the UK has voted to leave the European Union.
Yeah! President Obama's immigration plans knocked back by a deadlocked 4-4 Supreme Court.
It takes us further from the country that we aspire to be.
And civil rights legend and Congressman John Lewis led a sit-in in Congress to demand action, a vote on gun control.
We're calling on the leadership of the House to bring common sense gun control legislation to the House floor. Let us vote!
This hour on Point, our weekly news roundtable with Matea Gold, David Rennie, and On Point news analyst Jack Beattie. You can join us on air or online, where this conversation is always on. How will the UK's decision to leave the EU reverberate around the world? And what are you thinking on guns this week, immigration, Baltimore? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Joining us now from Washington is Matea Gold, national reporter for The Washington Post. Matea, thanks very much for being with us today.
Oh, great to be with you.
Also with us from Washington is David Rennie, Washington Bureau Chief for The Economist out of London. David, welcome.
Hi, Tom.
And from Hanover, New Hampshire, Jack Beattie joins us. Hello, Jack.
Hello, Tom, David, and Matea.
David Rennie, what has happened in your country today?
We've had a revolt against the government, against the ruling classes, against the business elite, against all the expert advice, and by a really hefty margin, the British people have voted to end 43 years of membership of the European Union.
Against the ruling classes, what do you mean?
So you had an extraordinary situation where at certain moments you could add up the list of people who had said that this was a bad and dangerous idea, mostly on economic grounds. You had the governor of the Bank of England, you had the head of the largest business organisation, you had the heads of some of the largest companies in Britain who between them employed 1.5 million people. You even had the Archbishop of Canterbury at one point weighing in. And I think a phrase that sums up this entire campaign was during one of the big TV debates, a Conservative minister campaigning to leave the European Union was reminded about all these experts, and he said, "I think this country has had enough of experts." And he got this a huge kind of roar of kind of angry applause from the audience, and that I think sums up where we've got to.
Who voted for Brexit? Who voted against it? Who voted to remain?
So it's an incredibly divided country. It's not really divided on left and right or party membership. It's much more divided, and it's kind of painful, really, to see your own country looking so kind of starkly broken down by colour. So whites voted to stay, non-whites voted to leave, the young overwhelmingly voted to stay, the old overwhelmingly voted to leave. Leave was basically a white, English, blue-collar, working-class, less-educated, pensioners, people who lived in the kind of towns that in the US we'd call Rust Belt kind of towns, post-industrial, very unhappy about globalization and its effects. And it became very much a kind of referendum about the elites, about immigration, about foreigners taking jobs and welfare. It became a very ugly campaign that didn't really wrestle with what actual model of relationship with Europe we would like now we've chosen to leave.
Non-whites voted to leave. Explain that.
No, sorry. Non-whites voted to stay. It was the whites who voted to leave. But the biggest, starkest thing was age. That was the single. It was like almost in lockstep. The older people were, the more likely they were to leave.
College graduates to remain. Non-college graduates to leave. Why
exactly
the revolt, David? Interpret it as best you can for us. Why?
So to try and kind of boil it down, this is partly the same forces that we see here with Donald Trump, and I suspect we'll get to that in a bit, the same forces you see in lots of rich Western democracies. There is a kind of global backlash against elites who are seen to have got a lot wrong in recent years. But there are also special things. Remember that when Britain joined the European Union 43 years ago, it joined reluctantly and it joined late. It joined a club written on other people's terms, basically a Franco-German project coming out of the Second World War to try and bring peace to Europe and help German industry get on with French farmers. Britain joined reluctantly, basically because in the 70s we thought that our economy was a basket case. If you remember all those strikes and terrible labor relations,
sure.
Just think of the cars that you could buy made in the UK in the 1970s. They were kind of global joke, and to put it simply, we looked across the English Channel and Europe looked more dynamic. So two big things changed. The economic crisis in Europe, particularly with the euro, the single currency. If you joined a club to have access to something dynamic and then that looks like an economic mess, you think, well, why am I still here? That's a big, big change. The other big change is immigration has become kind of identified with Europe. And that's really because after the Berlin Wall fell, the final act of the end of kind of communism in Europe was the arrival of those former communist countries, countries like Poland, the Czech Republic. They joined the European Union in a big wave. And then there was the question of would their citizens be allowed to work freely across the rest of Europe? And Britain stood out as the only large country that at the time allowed them to come and work. Now, we at The Economist would say that was a really smart thing to do. We got the best educated, the hardest working, the English-speaking Poles. They've been great for the economy. But it's been a large number of people, hundreds of thousands, and it caused a huge backlash. Although, oddly, the most hostile to immigration are the areas of England which have the fewest immigrants, whereas London, which has the most immigrants, was strongly in favour of Remain.
We have about 10,000 questions. We won't get to them all in this hour. Matea Gold, Donald Trump was in Scotland, of all places, at one of his own golf courses as this all came down and was applauding this from Scotland. How do you see this playing into American politics? Why Donald Trump's support for the Brexit, Matea?
So I think that this really is a shot of adrenaline for Trump and his campaign, and it clearly is going to cause incredible consternation among Democrats. And really, in keeping with the unscripted nature of Trump's entire bid, he actually seemed somewhat unaware of the Brexit vote just several weeks ago when he was asked about it by the Hollywood Reporter. He seemed to not recognize what it was, but has quickly—
And he was in Scotland to mark the rehabbing of a golf course or something.
Right.
I mean, that really
There really was no, I don't think, any strategic effort on his part to be there for the vote. But as it happens, I mean, and as we've often seen with his campaign and his candidacy, is he seems to really hit these key emotional moments that are in the populace at just the right time. And, you know, he very instinctively has seized on this and recognized that exactly what David was saying, that the forces that propelled the Leave vote to win in the UK are the same forces that are buoying his candidacy. He said this morning out of Scotland, people are really angry. They're really angry and upset. I think it's great. I mean, I think that what he's trying to articulate there is that, you know, this is a representation of people exercising their voice. And in a very sort of statesmanlike a reaction to the vote that he put out through his campaign that actually didn't really sound like Donald Trump's voice, but he talked about how this could be a restoration of Britain and all of its glory. He talked about how this is a rejection of the global elite. Really, all the themes that he has hit on in his campaign here in the United States.
It was wild to hear him really sort of, parodying is the wrong word, but sounding very much like former London Mayor Boris Johnson, a potential next Prime Minister of the UK. Talking about what this would mean for the UK, Donald Trump celebrating the same thing. Here was Johnson saying that the Brexit vote was Britain taking a step in the right direction.
It is the essence of our case that young people in this country can look forward to a more secure and more prosperous future if we take back the democratic control that is the foundation of our economic prosperity.
Jack Beatty, all kinds of parallels within that one statement there to what you might hear from Donald Trump in this country, and Boris Johnson's crowd won.
Yes, Frank Luntz, the pollster, said if a wave of populism can sweep Britain out of Europe, it can sweep Donald Trump into the presidency. There's one difference, though. Britain is 87% white. The United States, 63%. That's Hillary Clinton's advantage, or a possible advantage. It is a much more varied electorate here, much less responsive to Trump's nativist, nationalist appeal. On the other hand, this is no time to be coming out complacent and sounding like an uninflected defender of the status quo. This isn't a morning for the status quo.
What do you mean exactly by that, Jack?
Well, I mean that Hillary Clinton is running as a status quo candidate in a moment when it appears the international order everywhere, people are protesting against what they feel they can't control, globalization, immigration, the forces that are changing the world without people being able to affect them through elections. And And it's a dangerous moment to be saying, well, I think things are fine the way they are.
Yeah, here was German Chancellor Angela Merkel saying, well, no, things are not staying as they were. No getting away from it.
There is no way of beating about the bush. Today is a watershed event for Europe and for the European process of unification and integration.
David Rennie, I mean, what is happening here to what we have very recently even now called the West? Is it coming apart?
Look, I think it is where we should worry is not necessarily that everyone in Britain is signed up to something which is a kind of British version of Trumpism. I think it would be a mistake for listeners to think, okay, the whole of Britain is now basically racist and xenophobic and anti-immigrant. There were decent people on both sides of this debate. If I was going to get really gloomy this morning, I think one of the things that would make me gloomy if I was an American politician facing this election rather than a journalist just writing about it is this was kind of a post-truth campaign. And it turned out that the fact checkers had no power whatsoever. And so this is a first dry run of something that I would argue Donald Trump is trying here. So to take one fact, so the Leave campaign drove Boris Johnson, the mayor of London, former mayor of London, who probably will be the next prime minister, drove around Britain in a big red bus and painted on the side, it said, we send £350 million a week to Brussels. Let's spend that on the National Health Service. Now, that number is completely made up. And every serious news organization said, actually, you've triple counted, you've missed this, you've missed that. That number is totally bogus. He smiled, he waved, he got back in the bus and carried on driving around. And it was a complete success.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're looking at a week in the news. Britain will leave the EU. The Supreme Court blocks Obama on immigration, not guilty again in the Freddie Gray case in Baltimore. Trump, Hillary, LeBron brings it home. Democrats sit in on guns. David Rennie is with us, Washington Bureau Chief for The Economist out of London. Mattea Gold is here from The Washington Post, and Jack Beattie's here. You can join us as well. What do you think? What does the Brexit say? What will it mean? And where does the 4-4 court leave us on immigration? What about those undocumented millions in this country now? And what were you thinking as all those Democrats sat down on the floor of the House demanding a vote on gun legislation? At 10 Downing Street this morning, Prime Minister David Cameron trying to reassure people, at least in the short term.
I would reassure those markets and investors that Britain's economy is fundamentally strong. And I would also reassure Brits living in European countries and European citizens living here that there will be no immediate changes in your circumstances.
Medium term, long term, who knows? He says he will leave as prime minister, and there is so much in flux. Let's go to Thomas calling from Manlius, New York. Thomas, you're on the air. Thanks for calling.
Thank you for taking my call.
Your question, your comment.
My comment is that what's happened with the Brexit, I believe there is a startling parallel with the political situation in the United States. The promise of NAFTA, the promises being made about TPP, and the promises that were made about joining the European Union, the exact opposite has happened for working class people. It simply has not. Everybody was wrong. Globalization has damaged a great number of people who are not super well educated or already starting in the game with assets.
Thomas, let us pick it up. Mattea Gold, how about it? It is not hard to look at this and see the globalization project faltering in the rhetoric in this country and maybe more in action in the UK, a kind of end of a vision here, or the certainly right now a very rugged moment for it.
There's no question that that is what Trump has so effectively tapped into, and that's something that has been really the core of his campaign. I mean, if you look at his policies, really there's very few things that he's taken very strong and consistent positions on. And essentially, he has a campaign about protectionism and about retreating from America's place as a leader in globalization and trade and also in foreign affairs. I mean, that it is a complete rejection of what we saw over the last two decades. And I mean, one thing that I think has been such a challenge for Secretary Clinton is that so much of her legacy has been built on this outward-looking posture and her experience as Secretary of State, her obviously her husband's tenure and NAFTA coming in under his administration. That's a legacy she's really wrestling with and trying to position herself as someone who hears the very real concerns and anxieties that working-class people have, and having credibility on that issue is really what she's a balance she's trying to strike right now.
Donald Trump all over that this week on Wednesday, before the vote in New York, looking to refocus his campaign, lashed out at Hillary Clinton, criticized her time as Secretary of State.
Hillary Clinton's tryout for the presidency has produced one deadly foreign policy disaster after another. One by one, they're all bad. She's virtually done nothing right. She's virtually done nothing good.
David Rennie, you're with The Economist. The Economist has strongly supported the globalization project. Do you see that unraveling, being called out for not delivering for too many of the citizens right now, Britain?
Absolutely. Look, of course. Look, I've been based in Washington this time around for 4 years. Before that, I was 5 years in Brussels. I used to be in Asia. What is really striking about the politics of the present moment is how identical the complaints are in all the countries I've been covering elections in for the last 20 years. The American dream. Who stole the American dream? In the UK, it's who stole the British dream. In France, it's who stole the French dream. And these are countries with pretty different policies in terms of government spending and strong and weak labor unions and things. So what's the common factor? Well, the common factor is globalization. But I think the real flaw in the kind of populist argument, not that it holds them back, is that their big lie is to pretend that this was chosen, that dummy politicians, in Donald Trump's terms, chose deliberately to send all the jobs to China. Well, here's the thing. If you look at the year 1989, you imagine being a worker before then. China was not in competition with you. India was not in competition. It was basically a socialist autarky. The entire Soviet bloc was making stuff that no one really wanted. Between 1989 and 1999, the global stock of workers basically doubled from 1.5 to 3 billion people. So suddenly there was an unprecedented explosion of competition as countries like China just came back. They came back from this anomalous absence from the global economy. Everyone is absolutely seething with fury about the fact that there are no more of those jobs for life in factories in Midwestern towns or in Scotland or Wales or France or Belgium. But they existed in that post-war period partly because there was an artificial absence of competition.
Jack Meade, it is hard to argue, looking at the morning, the day after the Brexit, that political elites in England, but certainly in this country as well, didn't sit back and say, oh, it's terrible, it's too bad, about all the lost jobs and all the economic pain, but not really address it in all those years, Jack.
Yes, and with all that lobbying on the other side, I mean, let's not kid ourselves. The Clinton years were all about very effective corporate lobbying, not only for NAFTA, but for the opening to China.
And corporations have done fabulously well.
Fabulously well. While meanwhile, the Financial Times this week put really the fact, the economic fact of this election in a statistic. Fewer than 1 in 6 men in the United States without a college degree, fewer than 1 in 6 are even looking for work. I mean, that's the America wrought by deindustrialization, either because of technology or because of the flight of jobs. But in any case, that's one of the consequences.
A lot of people with a lot of jobs in China, you can total all up globally and say it worked quite well. But the pain felt in this country, in the UK voting that way. Mark in Edmond, Oklahoma. Mark, you're on.
Hi, Tom. Scotland just narrowly voted to stay as part of the UK recently.
Yes.
And I read online that both Scotland and Northern Ireland voted pretty overwhelmingly to stay in the EU. Is there a chance that the UK itself could fragment with Northern Ireland and Scotland going with the EU and Great Britain being left in the southern half of the island?
David Rennie.
It's a very good question. Absolutely. We've seen the leader of the Scottish government saying that she wants a second referendum, that democratically Scotland voted to stay in the European Union and now feels it's been left out. Northern Ireland is both more complicated and more frightening, because if you look at the vote in Northern Ireland, it fell exactly on Catholic and Protestant lines. All those sort of demons of violent sectarianism that we hoped we had buried, that border between Northern Ireland, controlled by the British, and Southern Ireland, the Republic of Ireland, had almost disappeared. You know, people went shopping on either side of that border. had jobs on either side of that border.
They'll be in different realms now.
They'll be in totally different, you know, different customs unions. Who knows what they'll be in? And that Northern Ireland vote incredibly split. So Protestants who are unionists who want to be part of the United Kingdom, they voted to leave the European Union. Catholics who favour nationalism, who would like a close relationship with Southern Ireland, they voted for the European Union. And you saw Sinn Féin, what used to be the political wing of the IRA, now one of the biggest parties in Northern Ireland, saying that this is also an argument that there's no legitimate rule from London anymore. So a lot of demons of the past kind of waking there.
This story by no means finished, but we have so much to look at this week in American news as well. I want to turn to the immigration front, the Supreme Court there, and of course, down a member and Republicans blocking that ninth member on the court, for the court, came to a 4-4 tie over President Obama's immigration policy, his plan to shield lots and lots of immigrants from deportation and allow them to work. That left in place a lower appeal court ruling blocking that plan. President Obama expressing deep disappointment about that yesterday.
I think it is heartbreaking for the millions of immigrants who made their lives here, who've raised families here, who hope for the opportunity to work, pay taxes, serve in our military, and more fully contribute to this country we all love.
But Republican House Speaker Paul Ryan called it a victory for separation of powers.
This is a win for the Constitution. It's a win for Congress. And it's a win in our fight to restore the separation of powers. Presidents don't write laws. Congress writes laws.
Matea Gold, did everybody see this coming?
Well, I think there was definitely anticipation that having a not a complete court was going to lead to some very dicey split decisions. This obviously is one that has huge ramifications, and conservatives celebrating this obviously as what they say is a curb on President Obama's attempt to expand his executive powers. I do think, though, for the fall, this has some pretty serious implications. We're already seeing incredible anger and activism in Latino communities responding to this. There was already a spike in efforts to register voters in Latino communities. I think those efforts are going to accelerate, and could actually be a countervailing force against some of the support for Trump and really boost Secretary Clinton's efforts on the ground.
David in Lexington, Massachusetts. David, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Hi, Jack. This is a great victory for American workers.
Which? Do you mean the immigration ruling, David?
Yes, yes.
Okay.
The key thing about the executive action is not stopping deportations. Obama already did that. It is giving out work permits. Well, since the millennium, there are an additional 9.3 million jobs, 18 million immigrants, additional immigrants, and 16.5 million working-age Americans. No wonder, as Jack said, so many Americans have given up even looking for work. And then there's the moral hazard, which is that every time you legalize immigrants, more come illegally. Obama could have signaled that he was concerned about that, but by including a national mandatory E-Verify in his executive action, but he did not do that.
But, David, don't you think those 4 million, I guess, in question here, will be working anyway, most of them?
Not if there's a national mandatory E-Verify.
But there's not, and you know that, David. So I'm asking,
I know that, but there should be, and I'm, you know, an activist working on that, among other things.
Yeah, I hear where you're coming from, Jack Beatty, there, saying, come on, do the math. We need the jobs. Don't hand out work permits to people who aren't legal residents.
And if he had the information, this is the kind of case Mr. Trump would make, and that had gained some traction. The counter argument is the one you make, Tom. They're working anyway, and often at jobs, almost exclusively at jobs that the Americans, native born Americans, don't want or won't do. Today on Morning Edition, John Burnett out of Texas interviewed a Spanish speaking maid
in a hotel.
At a hotel. And, you know, she basically said they were worried. They had planned to, you know, travel in the United States and go places.
And to Mexico.
Into Mexico and to get a driver's license. But now they're putting, and they had put together all their records showing they had been here, I think, since 2001.
They were ready to jump on that
work
permit and
they were ready to do it.
Yep.
And all over the country, these people who contribute to the economy are being told to wait and wait and wait some more. And of course, you know, as Matteo says, this thrusts the issue right into the national campaign. Univision, the Spanish language television network, it's running a drive to register 3 million new Hispanic voters, and it's led by their top journalist Jorge Ramos, mm-hmm. who was personally thrown out of a Trump news conference. There are a lot of angry Hispanic voters out there today.
David Rennie, put this Supreme Court vote on immigration, a decision on immigration in the U.S. in the context of what we just saw in the Brexit. I mean, immigration was a big deal there as well. Are there connective tissues here, David?
I think there are. It's also really important to narrow down on who the people are who lost out from this ruling. These are the parents, the largest group of them, it's slightly complicated, but the largest group is parents of people who were the beneficiaries of previous kind of actions. A lot of these people, they have U.S.-born citizen children. So I've done a lot of reporting on Hispanics. I wrote a 14-page special for The Economist last year on Hispanics in America. You go to towns like Nashville, Tennessee. You go to places like Twin Falls, Idaho, which have these new sort of very fast-growing Hispanic populations. The classic scenario is you have a bunch of Hispanic kids in school who are born in the U.S., who are U.S. citizens, but their parents are undocumented. And you're absolutely right, Tom. They work in places like chicken processing plants or abattoirs or vegetable kind of processing factories. And these factories, they're pretty open about the fact, particularly agriculture, the majority of their workers are undocumented because people just don't want to do it. But the key is that their children are citizens. So even if you could build Mr. Trump's kind of wall, if you could put a hermetic dome over the U.S., in political electoral terms, their children, even if you keep these parents out forever, as clearly David, your listener, would like to do, their kids are here and they're U.S.-born citizens. And one of the statistics you hear from Latino activists a lot is that every single year, 900,000 Latino kids turn 18 and reach voting age who are citizens in this country. Now, for the moment, they haven't voted in large numbers. They've been a big disappointment for the Democrats. But, you know, many more of these rulings, the hope of the Democrats is clearly that they will become angry voters.
Laura in Des Moines, Iowa. Laura, you're on the air. Thank you for calling.
Well, thanks, Tom. You know, I originally told your producer I was going to talk about gun control, but after that last call, I have to say, as a small businesswoman here in Des Moines, I have a cleaning company, and I pay my people about $13 an hour.
Okay.
That's pretty high above the average. And my best workers are Latinos. And I have to take offense to this gentleman. The jobs that white people want to do in this country are leaving, okay? The jobs that Latinos are doing in this country, primarily, especially undocumented, are jobs that nobody else wants. And they are also paying taxes, like that gentleman said. So that is just ridiculous. Our Constitution says nothing about kicking parents out of people who are citizens. So that just makes me really angry.
But how does that turn out if we've got, you know, immigrant residents who are taking the jobs and Americans who don't want the jobs that are there? How does that settle out, Laura?
Well, I mean, first of all, local economy is where it's at. That is where the trend is going all across this country. It is bringing back jobs to local economies, farming, local economies. And, you know, the structure is built on the backs of immigrants in this country. And right now, they're mostly Latino. So, you know, we need to work on getting our jobs back in this country in a way that works for us. I mean, that's one thing I agree on with Trump, like the only thing, because I think that those are the jobs, you know, the technical jobs, and things have changed. I mean, we are now a tech society. That's where the money is for people who have higher education in this country.
Laura, I appreciate your call. Matteo Gold is short before the break here, but you say it's a shot of adrenaline, the Brexit vote for the Trump campaign. On the other hand, right here may be a red flag to many Latino voters in this country. How's it settle out, the week's push, Matteo?
Well, I think both sides are going to have their own constituencies buoyed by very huge news events with huge ramifications. It's continuing to accelerate the tightness in this presidential race.
I'm I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. In other news this week, LeBron James and the Cleveland Cavaliers took the NBA championship in the seventh game, and the city reveled in its first major sports win in 52 years.
Final seconds. It's over. It's over. Cleveland is a city of champions once again. The Cavaliers are NBA champions.
A brutal week of weather in the West, record-busting high temperatures, dozens of wildfires, more lives lost.
This morning, the West is boiling over, a dangerous combination of excessive heat warnings and wildfires baking the region.
And mournful bluegrass music legend Ralph Stanley has died at 89. Lately, yes, we have, Ralph. We're looking at a week in the news. Britain will leave the EU. The Supreme Court blocks Obama on immigration. Not guilty again in the Freddie Gray case. Trump, Hillary, LeBron James brings it home, and Democrats sit in on guns. David Rennie is with us from The Economist. Matea Gold from The Washington Post. Jack Beatty's here. You can join us. What were you thinking as all those Democrats sat down on the floor of the House? Will any policeman be found guilty in Baltimore in the Freddie Gray case? Did you hear Trump lambaste Hillary? Hillary lambaste Trump. And what do you make of Trump's empty campaign coffers? Are you sweltering in that Western heat, applauding the ban on Russian runners celebrating the Cleveland Cavs? I want to look at that remarkable sit-down on the floor of the House. And this time we literally mean the floor. Congressman John Lewis, who, of course, was there in the heat and midst of the civil rights movement, still there as Democrats sort of broke protocol, said, enough, enough, enough. Here was John Lewis.
Today we come to the well of the House to dramatize the need for action. Not next month, not next year, but now, today. Sometime you have to do something out of the ordinary. Sometimes you have to make a way out of no way. We have been too quiet for too long. There comes a time when you have to say something, when you have to make a little noise. Yes.
That's right.
Make a little noise about guns and gun legislation. They did not get it. Matea Gold, put this in context for us. There was a big appropriations bill here. And what exactly were the legislative maneuvers with Paul Ryan before the Democrats sat down there in the front of the House in the well?
Well, Paul Ryan has called this a stunt, and I think in some ways that's a fair assessment, but I do think it's probably something that has remarkable political resonance. I mean, the House Democrats were using the final days that the House was in session to try to force a vote on these gun control measures, and I don't think any of them actually had any anticipation that that effort would be successful. But there is no question that this is a remarkable turning point when it comes to gun policies and politics here in this country. I remember covering the reaction on Congress after Newtown and after the slaughter of these first graders. And if there was ever a moment that many of us thought we would see a shift in actually some movement on the Hill for gun control legislation, it was that. And that was very quickly extinguished. And I think the Democrats feel that they have an opening here, not necessarily because their Republican colleagues are going to come around, but because I think they sense the politics have changed and that they are taking advantage of this election year to really try to create a movement that they can go back now to their constituents, talk to them in town hall meetings over the summer, and try to at least make a stand on this when it comes to voting in the fall.
Jack Beatty, it was a remarkable tableau. Just looking at it, yes, there are politics here, but it's been a while since we've seen that kind of symbolic demonstration in that kind of setting around anything. And here it is on guns after Orlando.
After Orlando, and led by a man with, you know, unexampled moral authority, John Lewis. No one who knows his history can listen to him without being moved. And you don't use the word stunt. It seems to me, appropriately, with John Lewis involved. And it had an effect. While that was going on, the Senate was actually voting by a majority to adopt a relatively mild compromise bipartisan bill limiting the no-fly, no-buy to about the list of about 2,700 American citizens. Eight Republicans voted with the Democrats. They got a majority. They may not be able to, in the final vote, get the 60 votes needed to pass it. But that vote yesterday was the biggest defeat suffered by the NRA in recent times.
Oren in Stonington, Connecticut. Oren, thank you for calling. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom. I just wanted to say that, you know, people are describing this as a political stunt. But my question is, regardless of whether, you know, how you want to describe it, what are we supposed to do with a government that can't bring an issue to a vote, that most simple idea, the cornerstone of legislation, bringing an issue to a vote with a 25-hour sit-in? What are we supposed to do now if, you know, our government has already shown that they're not going to allow the passing of a Supreme Court judge, and we've seen the results of that? What happens when we have a government that's refusing to even make decisions about the things that, you know, myself as a constituent of Connecticut, that we care about? What's our choice then?
Jack Beatty, speak to that. There is frustration on many sides at the just kind of, I mean, do-nothing Congress is a very old phrase. It seems bigger than that these days.
Congress is certainly the Republican House is on strike and has been on strike. Certainly, we talked about immigration. You know, the bipartisan bill passed the Senate. The House wouldn't even take it up. Went on strike. That's why the president resorted to his executive order. You know, in their defense, Paul Ryan and Republicans would say, look, the House of Representatives is not the Senate. The minority has no rights here. It is a strictly majority rule body, and the Speaker is completely within his jurisdiction to say what is and what is not kind of come up for a vote. And that's what Paul Ryan did.
And yet Oren is looking for his agenda to be represented in the House. Bill in Nashville. Bill, you're on the air.
Hey, Tom. Thanks a lot. Hey, this is a total example of anarchy and the lawlessness of the Democrats. They had the possibility of going through committee. It failed. Discharge position for they didn't even try that. There was legal means, and to come in here and take the House, and I just can't imagine what's going to happen whenever they come back, and what are they going to have to do? Get guards in there to move them? But all you and the media all hail this anarchy and say that this is great. And the last thing I'd like to say is that one thing we have to do is we have to get somebody. There's four liberals on this panel today. And I listen to it every day. There's always four examples. Do you think people want to listen to somebody that only gives one side of an issue?
Well, I tell you what, Bill, I absolutely would not agree that we just give one side of an issue. And I don't think that it's hailing anarchy here. I think people are saying, look, there's a lot of passion after the many deaths in Orlando, and some Americans want to see that represented and did there. You say it's purely illegal. It looks like anarchy to you. I take your point, and I take it fully. Let me get one more right here. Dwayne, Walterboro, South Carolina. Dwayne, you're on.
Thank you for taking my call, Tom. I just wanted to make a point that I think the issue here is due process. And I think, let me just explain why that's a fundamental right under the Constitution, notice and a hearing.
You're talking about the gun issue, Dwayne, the gun issue.
Right, the gun issue, right.
How so, sir?
From my understanding, the Democrats want, if you're on the no-fly list or if you're on the terrorist list, you shouldn't be able to buy a gun. There's no due process to be put on that list. You do not have a fundamental right to fly an airplane or to ride in an airplane, but you do have a fundamental right to bear arms. That's protected under the Constitution. And so when you want to take away that right without a notice or a hearing, that is against the Constitution, and I'm sorry our Democrats don't understand that. And to have them sitting on the floor of the House, if there was a way to have them arrested, that ought to happen, because they just don't get it. They are
Dwayne, how would you confront the kind of problems that we've seen in Newtown, the kind that we saw in Aurora, the kind that we saw most recently in Orlando? How would you confront that problem?
Well, we'd have to think about it, and I understand.
Haven't we been thinking
done,
about it for a long time?
Right. But what doesn't need to be done is to violate our Constitution. That's not right. You know, you can't take away a fundamental right without first letting me know about it and also allowing me to be in front of an impartial judge or jury.
Dwayne, point fully taken. Point fully
advocated.
Yeah, we got it. Dwayne, I appreciate your call. Matea, how do you see this playing out? John Lewis said, we'll be back in July when they come back in session, and we will continue this. And you've got people saying, go, man, go. And you've got others saying, this is anarchy. Arrest these people. How do you see this playing out, Matea?
Well, there's no question that House Democrats are seizing on this issue and taking it back to their districts. As I mentioned over the break, the 4th of July break, they're also aggressively fundraising off of this, which I think has sparked quite a bit of criticism from the right. But I think it will have serious resonance as well in the presidential campaign. And, you know, it's been interesting watching Trump try to navigate this issue. He came out initially and said, I want to talk to the NRA and make sure that we can keep terrorists from getting guns, and suggested that he might be open to some gun control measures, and then appeared to walk away from that. And he has really very strongly said and asserted many times that Secretary Clinton wants to overturn the Second Amendment, which is obviously not true, but she obviously supports gun control measures that he doesn't. And so we'll continue to see this divide, I think, both in the congressional races and in the White House contest.
One more on this front. We've got to go to Baltimore as well. Jacob in Charlotte, North Carolina. Jacob, you're on the air.
Hi, thank you. I just wanted to take a minute to add that I share the sentiment of a previous caller. It is quite ridiculous that our representatives have to resort to something like staging sit-ins to just get a vote passed. This is pretty common sense stuff. We're not talking about getting rid of people's rights to own firearms. We're just talking about protecting people.
But what about those on our callers right here who say this is anarchy, this is unconstitutional, they're asking for something that offends the Constitution here, they should be arrested. Jacob?
Look, I'm a avid shooter and gun owner myself, but far too often we see people who grab assault rifles and shoot up schools or clubs.
Yeah, it's painful.
It happens so frequently. Something clearly needs to be done.
It's painful, and it's happened. It happens a lot, and it's happened at such a huge scale in Orlando. And you see a response to that right here. And resistance to those movements. Yesterday, Baltimore acquittal in the case of the policeman who was driving the police van in which Freddie Gray got his accused of a rough ride. Of course, Freddie Gray ended up dead. The officer, Caesar Goodson, 46, had faced the most serious charges of any of those six officers indicted in Gray's arrest and death last April. Acquitted yesterday. After that, here people were furious over that in Baltimore. Here was one protester outside the courthouse talking with the Baltimore Sun.
I'm outraged right now. It's disgusting. And then they want us, so it's going to be many more Freddie Grays, many more Tyrone West, many more Anthony Edisons. Thanks to this bullcrap judicial system. It sucks.
Frustration in Baltimore and callers on that front as well. William in Nashville. William, you're on the air. Thank you for calling.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for taking my call.
Yes.
I disagree with the prior caller a bit when he said you all are one side. I think you do a great job of fleshing out the issues, whether I agree with him or not.
Okay.
I would point out something on this Baltimore thing. One thing I do take issue with is the way the question is even being phrased on your show this morning. Okay. Will any of the police officers be charged?
They've been charged. I'm asking if anybody will be found guilty.
Sorry, be convicted. Excuse me, be found guilty.
Yeah.
I think the question should be, should any of the police officers be found guilty? I looked extensively at the evidence. I'm an attorney.
Okay.
And they had video of that ride, large amounts of video of that ride. There was simply no rough ride. The judge lambasted the prosecution, saying what they promised, what they told the public, what they told the court was completely inconsistent with reality, that the charges had no basis, that he went through each and every element of the charges. They're ridiculous charges to make, given the facts. And the press has only talked about people on the outside saying, I can't believe none of these guys are going to jail. I can't believe they charged people and tried to put police officers in jail over not doing anything wrong.
But, William, just let me – I mean, I haven't looked at the video. You have. You're an attorney. I'm not. But Freddie Gray was taken into custody, and he came out – ended up dead.
Yes. And what the judge specifically found is that the evidence showed that the injuries were internal. They couldn't be seen. There was a co –
Fair enough, but you don't die just for no reason. I mean, the guy in police custody ended up dead, and people wonder, what happened here?
Yeah, they should have seat-belted him, but that's negligence, not criminal homicide. Criminal homicide, you have to have intent to kill. And what they found specifically is that while they should have seatbelted him, he stood up while he was in the back of the car inappropriately. He was not making noise, according to the co-passenger, who was also a person going to jail. Well,
William, we've got it. Our time is so short. Forgive me. Our time is so short. I want to get one more right here. I appreciate yours. Mac in Atlanta, Georgia, you're on. Our time's short, Mac. What do you think?
Hi, Tom. I'm an African-American. I'll say this. The problem I have with this is that the police officers keep getting away with stuff like this, and that's the problem that why black Americans don't believe in this country. And because of callers just like him, they're always making them excuses. But he did this. But he did that. He shouldn't have been dead, period. He should be able to go to jail and get out. And I don't think that's too much to ask for any American citizen.
Mac, I very much appreciate your call as well. Wow. Jack, a week of news so large, it's hard to get our hands around it. From major, major moves in London right through to immigration here, big deal for this country. Guns, and there's the Freddie Gray case sitting in front of us. We have big pieces in motion right now, Jack.
We do, and you use the phrase, the metaphor earthquake, and I think in almost all of these realms, what happened in Britain is going to be felt here in some way or another, that political establishments, that settled orders are not settled, that things are up for grabs.
Matea, does Donald Trump have his mojo back after this week and his, victory lap for Brexit in Scotland?
I think there's no question that he's energized. We will see how consistent he can be as a campaigner. That's something he has yet to prove that he can do.
David Rennie, do you fear for your nation, sir?
I do. It's a bleak day.
A bleak day from the view of the Washington bureau chief of The Economist. David Rennie, we thank you for being with us on this day of all days. Thank you very much. We look forward to your continued reporting. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
Matea Gold, national reporter for The Washington Post. Matea, it's always great to have you. Thank you for joining us today.
My pleasure, Tom.
And Jack Beatty, thank you as always for being here.
Thank you.
Listeners, you can continue this conversation and get the On Point podcast at our website, onpointradio.org. Follow us on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. I'm on Twitter at Tom Ashbrook NPR. Thanks for joining us today. This is On Point.